We're discussing the IRS, tax avoidance, and the future of banking information on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The IRS has just published its financial report. It's a comprehensive snapshot of its financial activities, managing more than $4 trillion in tax revenue. The IRS's chief financial officer said in the statement the IRS disbursed an unprecedented $1.1 trillion to Americans in fiscal year 2021. Should Congress raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans? And if so, by how much? What should change about tax policy in America? 800-642-1234 to join in. Paul Keel is a reporter covering the IRS and taxes for ProPublica. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, as you look out at the amount of money sloshing around in the IRS, you've covered the IRS for a long time. What are some initial thoughts on how the IRS is functioning and the state of taxation in America? What should we bear in mind?
Yeah, well, those are two very different questions. And the IRS is kind of easier to answer in that it's been gutted by budget cuts that started back in 2011. And the audit rate has plunged to the lowest that I could find going back to like the 1950s and 40s. And just a straight result of the fact that they've lost over tens of thousands of auditors at this point by virtue of they didn't have the budget to keep people on. I'm sure no one really loves dealing with the IRS. And, you know, as time goes on, you know, there's aspects of dealing with the IRS that seem, you know, progressively in the past, there've been attempts to like get them to be more like online and electronic. And I mean, if you deal with your bank and then you deal with the IRS, you realize how much in the past they are. And that's just a straight result of the fact of them not getting investment. And, you know, if you want to call the IRS, you're going to end up on hold because they don't have the people. And so, there's been some push from the left, mainly from Democrats, to restore some of the funding that has been cut over the last 10 years in particular. And that's part of this bill that's going forward. So that seems like it has survived so far, although there has not been support from the right for that. There is some bipartisan support for the idea that the IRS shouldn't be, you know, cut to the lowest level it's been ever. But it's hard to get broad Republican support for increasing the budget of the IRS.
We're going to look more at legislation, but what would fix the IRS? What would give it more teeth, more power, make us more fearful of it, if you will? Or should it have more power?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, you know, we have a lot of complicated problems as a country, and this is not one of them. It's just they need to hire more people. And kind of the basic thing I always tell people is that if you are a lower income or middle income person, to the extent you have any interaction with the IRS, you're going to be audited by a computer, because virtually everything about your financial life is fairly easy for the IRS to keep track of. So they get W-2s from your employer. If you have some interest from a bank account, or you own some stocks or a mutual fund and you get dividends or interest, those information reports are sent to the IRS. They basically know everything about your financial life. And so often, you know, people in that bracket aren't even what you would call audited. You know, if they overstate something, you know, how much income they got, you know, this computer picks it up and sends them a letter and say, hey, you were wrong about that. But when you get up further at the income scale, you talk about people who are business owners or even the wealthy, you need a person to audit those people. And that's what has suffered in particular with the loss of staff due to the budget cuts. So if you want to restore some of the equity in terms of, you know, how much scrutiny people get from the IRS, you need to have more skilled auditors, because it's a difficult job to be a really good auditor, particularly of the wealthy, because their financial situations can be quite complicated, because they have very smart professionals helping them make things complicated. So when you cut back, that's what happens. You lose the skilled auditors, and the audit rate, particularly for the wealthy, plunges.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Paul Keel, who's a reporter covering the IRS and taxes for ProPublica. We're looking at developments within the IRS. You can join in. Should the wealthy be taxed more? Do you support a tax on billionaires? Are you worried about the reach of the IRS? 800-642-1234. You mentioned there, Paul, the IRS knowing everything about our financial life. And the Biden administration has directed the IRS earlier this year to collect more data on every bank account with more than $600 in annual transactions. Where are we? What is happening with that piece?
Well, it became very controversial, and it seems to have been dropped from the legislation. But some background on that is that, you know, the IRS does this report every few years, and it's called the tax gap report. And basically, it's a report to say, hey, how much tax people owe but they don't pay, and they should pay. And the biggest chunk of that is people simply not reporting income that they get. And the biggest chunk of that chunk is business owners who have, let's say, cash businesses, or even not necessarily cash businesses, but they engage in transactions that are not captured by, you know, the information reporting that I was talking about. So there's no W-2 that's being sent to the IRS that's telling the IRS about these transactions. So that allows someone the opportunity of just telling the IRS, you know, that they didn't get that money. They're just omitting it from their tax return. And so for decades, there's been kind of calls on Capitol Hill to close the tax gap, to make sure that people who owe tax pay tax. And, you know, it's a basic fairness issue, but it's also a revenue issue, that there'd be less pressure to raise tax rates than everybody else if everyone who owed tax paid it. So this bank reporting idea is one that's been around for a while, and it's essentially what the proposal on the table was going to be. Like, the bank would just, if someone had transactions in a year that exceeded a certain amount, and I think it started at $600 and went up to $10,000 before the idea was dropped altogether. The idea was the IRS would just get, you know, a short form from the bank saying, this is how much went out, this is how much went in. And the reason the IRS would want that is if someone on their tax return says they earned $40,000, but they had, you know, $500,000 going in and out of the bank account, the IRS would say, aha, maybe we should take a closer look at this person. But it became very controversial. There was like the idea that the IRS was spying on your bank account. I think a lot of people got the impression that the IRS would get, like, you know, transactions, a bank account. I mean, it's such an immense amount of data. I don't think the IRS would know what to do with it. They can't do anything. They're overwhelmed. They have, you know, resources is the issue. You need a person to audit, you know.
Yeah.
So just, you know, be dead, it'd be flowing in a computer. But that's why they wanted it. And that was the idea behind the proposal, but it became such a, you know, a liability for the bill overall that they ended up dropping it.
Were the issues around privacy concerns, was that the main driver of, you know, tamping it down?
Well, I think people, I mean, like I said, if you have a job, the IRS knows how much you make. If you make interest in your bank account, the IRS gets a report saying, here's the interest you got. If you get money from stocks, if you, you know, I think they're going to try to do more like information reporting, even on cryptocurrency. And it comes from the basic fact that when they do these studies of who's evading tax, if the IRS gets an information report about your income, there's very little tax evasion that happens. So the amount of tax evasion that happens for people who have W-2s is like 1%. But the types of income that are not reported to the IRS, the amount of evasion is like less than half is reported. So that's what they're trying to get at. So the question is, like, do you think it's spying of the IRS, like, to be sent how much you made from your employer, or how much, you know, you earn from your stocks and dividend payments, versus how much went in and out of your bank account? I don't know. I guess someone can make that argument. But to me, it's all of a piece of this idea that, you know, to stop tax evasion, the IRS kind of needs a independent source of information to see whether what you're putting in your tax return is correct or not.
ProPublica's Paul Keel covers the IRS and its ability to administer our nation's tax laws. Would you give up a certain level of privacy so the IRS could better identify tax evaders? What are the trade-offs here? How do you feel about a billionaire tax? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Paul Keel here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
You're with us as we discuss the IRS here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. ProPublica obtained documents earlier this year reviewing how the ultra-wealthy avoid taxes, and it recently did some reporting, looked at a ton of IRS records, identifying at least 18 billionaires who received stimulus payments. You can join in. How do you feel about the tax structure in America as the IRS has announced higher federal income tax brackets for 2022 amid inflation? 800-642-1234. ProPublica's Paul Keel covers the IRS and stays with us. Let's go to Carl now, joining us from Great Falls, Montana. Hi, Carl. What's on your mind?
Well, these billionaires made their wealth on the common man. Shouldn't they be appropriately sharing the wealth to the general public where they made their money from?
Carl, what I hear you saying is that these billionaires should be taxed.
Yes, they should be taxed. It's called sharing the wealth that they gained from the common man that seems to be struggling for how they're supporting these billionaires by buying their items that they put on the shelf, like Walmart and all those other megagalopolis that make money off the common man.
Carl, thanks for the call. Paul, what are you seeing by way of your reporting on how billionaires are taxed or get away without paying tax?
Yeah, so there's the basic fact of our tax system that it's based on income. It's not based on wealth. And what that means is it means for the super wealthy, and I'm talking like the Jeff Bezoses and Elon Musks, the world, you know, and there's like 700 billionaires in the country. They have a lot more control over income that they take. So, I mean, you know, your typical, you know, founder CEO like Bezos doesn't take a salary. And often that's portrayed as, you know, them showing confidence in the company that their, you know, their financial, you know, future is tied to the fate of the company. But that also means, you know, salaries are very easy for the system to tax. Whereas if you're someone like Bezos, where the vast amount of your wealth is tied up in the stocks of your company, and your stock is getting, the stock is, you know, rising in value a lot. And that's what has made, you know, Musk and Bezos, like, you know, billionaires 100 times over. That's not captured by our system at all. You have to take a step to turn that wealth increase into income. So you have to sell the stock, for instance. And there's a lot of incentive not to do that. So one thing you can do if you have this vast amount of wealth at your disposal is you can borrow against it the same way someone might take a mortgage against their house. And you can pay an interest rate of, you know, 2 or 3% as opposed to, you know, selling stock and ending up paying, you know, 20-23% tax. So that's like a basic fact about our system. And so one thing we did is we looked at the taxes paid by people like Bezos and Musk and Warren Buffett, and found that when you looked at how much richer they got in a certain number of years compared to how much tax they paid, you get answers like 1%, 2%, 3%. So they're avoiding income on anything on par with how much richer they're getting in that time period. And this is a difference between the super wealthy and people who are even like rich. So we did a story about sports teams owners. So owning a sports team is actually like a big tax write-off. So you can buy a team, and then you get to write off essentially a lot of the value of that team over time. So you end up like get to put like a negative amount on your taxes, which lowers your taxes. And so when you look at the tax rate of sports teams owners, and you compare that to like even very successful athletes like LeBron James or somebody like that, so like LeBron James pays like 37% tax rate because he's getting money like in the form of salary a lot of the time.
But owning the team itself is a liability.
Right. Well, the team is actually, meanwhile, the team is rising in value. It's a pretty good investment to own a professional sports franchise, but it's a tax write-off for the billionaire, and the billionaire paid like a tax, you know, a very low tax rate because they're able to write off a lot of the stuff and they have other deductions at their disposal.
Wow.
And so it's really like a gap between the top 0.001% and even the 1%, what sometimes it's called the working rich, you know, someone who like, you know, like a big time, you know, executive or something like that, who gets a lot of income, that person is taxed in a very different way from someone who was wealthy.
Let's bring on Grant now in La Crosse. Grant, hi, what is your question?
Hi. I remember hearing at some point that the IRS was one of the few government entities that was actually profitable. Like, the more money you put in, they'd actually get a return on investment. I was wondering if there was any truth to that. And I'll take my answer up here.
Grant, thanks.
Yeah,
Paul.
So that is, just think about any business. There's sides, there's businesses, there's parts of businesses that do collections, or there's parts of businesses that, the revenue collection side of the business. That's like, that's what the IRS is for the company. It's the IRS, it's the revenue service, right? And so I don't think there's any serious debate that that is true, that the more money you put in the IRS, obviously there's some endpoint where this wouldn't be true anymore, but we're way, way, way away from that. The more money you put in the IRS, you get it back, right? So the different kind of measures, again, 4-to-1, or depends on if you like how much you target it. Like, you sometimes you see estimates like 10-to-1, like if you put it in the collections. I mean, we're where we are right now, like we have the lowest audit rate, like I said, that I could find going back decades. There was a big kind of scandal that there were like millionaires who just hadn't simply filed taxes, and the IRS had never gotten around to even like trying to pursue them. That's where we are right now. So if you put more money in, you're going to get more money out, because the IRS is in such a low state, right now. Academics like to muse about which point would you like, would that stop being true? Like, the IRS is such a monster and has like, millions of agents. At some point, that wouldn't be true anymore, but we're not even remotely close to that point.
Paul Keel with us, reporter covering the IRS for a long time for ProPublica, discussing the role of the IRS in our lives and taking your questions. Frank now in Delafield. Frank, hi, go ahead.
Hello, thank you. My question is that it's been well documented that Donald Trump has falsified his tax returns for a number of years. And I guess my question is, if we're auditing low-income and middle-class participants, then why wouldn't they catch a Donald Trump doing obvious falsifying of tax returns?
Well, the New York Times, people remember, got Donald Trump's returns, and it came to light that actually there is a big transaction of his that is being audited as a subject of an audit. He basically generated a huge, huge deduction, over $600 to $700 million. That is in question, whether he could have done that or not. And that's what, when he would say, he would always say, like, I can't release my taxes because I'm under audit. That was never a good justification, because he totally could have released his tax returns regardless of whether he's audited or not. I mean, the IRS already knows everything because they're auditing him. He apparently is under audit. And so, in general, the IRS has trouble going after, big time taxpayers. Big time taxpayers, have armies of extremely smart, capable people from big law firms or, the big four accounting firms to help them out. I mean, I did a story about Microsoft. Microsoft had this big kind of tax move that they did, where they put everything in Puerto Rico and dodged like tens of billions of tax. And you had like a couple people at the IRS going up against teams, like dozens of, PhDs and very smart lawyers on the other side who were there to help them, not pay taxes, essentially. So it is, the IRS against the little guy is often like the big boogeyman, but for taxpayers at this level, they're not afraid of the IRS. The IRS is afraid of them.
Let's circle back to legislation here and flesh this out, because Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden of Oregon proposed a tax on billionaires that was late last month. What is the status of this legislation?
I don't think it's made it into the more recent version. So okay. There was a lot of kind of panic and confusion, because I think, this one senator, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, didn't like the idea of raising tax rates. Essentially what the Democrats were going to do was undo some of what the Trump tax bill did in terms of lowering corporate tax rates and tax rates for the rich. And for some reason, I don't think I've heard an articulation of a reason, but she didn't like that idea. And so that sent kind of a scramble for other ideas. And Senator Ron Wyden has long, put forward this idea. It would get at what I was talking about before. It would say, you wouldn't have to wait for the billionaire to turn the increased wealth into taxable income. It would automatically do that. That would be a big change, and there's a lot of kind of complications to work through. And so it's sort of a race to put it together, but I don't know how serious it ever was, really, that it was going to get passed, and it eventually was kind of dropped.
Very quickly, Paul, due to inflation, all of the tax bracket thresholds are rising faster than normal. What are you watching for there?
You know, the IRS adjusts that every year, but there are things that inflation can erode people will not be aware of. So the child tax credit was $1,000 for a really long time, and it just stayed at $1,000 for over a decade, I believe, which actually was kind of a stealth tax increase on families, but no one really talked about it that way. So there are things where inflation can particularly hurt, I think, middle income and low income people that often isn't paid attention to.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Paul Keel is a reporter covering the IRS and taxes for ProPublica. Ahead this hour, we talk about the expanded federal child tax credit with a tax professional. You can join in 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the federal child tax credit and what to think about tax-wise as the year comes to a close. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Child tax credit payments continue to be dispersed in an effort to ease the financial burden brought on by the pandemic. And the IRS announced some families could be entitled to an increased payment for the month of December, depending on certain factors. Have you been receiving advanced child tax credit payments? Did you opt out of the advanced payments? Are you confused about how those payments could affect your taxes? It's 800-642-1234. Mary Mellum is a tax professional in Green Bay, an enrolled agent licensed by the IRS. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with those child tax credits. The Biden administration has been sending money as those monthly payments since July. How will it affect people's taxes?
Well, one of the tough things is that there is a reconciliation process that will ask when you file your tax return, you'll calculate the credit. And in doing so, it'll ask you how much did you already receive, and the credit that you have on the tax return will be reduced by the amount that you've already gotten up front. If someone comes in with a preconceived notion, they have children under the age of 6, which is $3,600, and they're expecting $3,600 times the number of their of children, and they've received the advance payments, they may not realize they're not getting all of that $3,600 at that point in time.
At tax time.
And if they, yes, and if they have set their withholding such that they need that money to pay the taxes, worst case scenario, they could end up owing money instead of getting extra back. It just depends on everybody's circumstance. But the biggest thing is that when they do their tax return, either professionally or on their own, they have to know how much they've received.
What could it mean if the IRS miscalculated how much money a parent was owed?
Well, the IRS did not miscalculate. The IRS based their advances theoretically on the 2020 tax return. But if they had not filed the 2020 tax return at the time they were sending out the payments, they look back to 2019. The biggest problem is the family that rotates the children. In, for instance, a divorced family where one parent claims the child one year and another parent claims the child the next year, depending on which year they happen to look at, would depend on who is getting the advanced payments. And again, worst case scenario, one parent could be getting the payments that is not entitled to it in 2020, and that parent will have to pay that money back.
So there needs to be a lot of cross communication with those two parents in order to figure out who has what money, it seems.
Well, either that, or if both parents had opted out of the payments, and collected them when they filed the tax return, neither one of them would have a problem.
What about this opting out? I understand that you have been recommending people that they should have opted out of this advance payment. What is your thinking there?
Sometimes people rely on their refunds for things that go on. Lots of times when you get money early or arbitrarily, it's easy to spend it. And then when you need it, it's not there. And so I'm not an advocate of the money up front. Granted, for some people, it's what they're living on. But then when those payments stop, you've changed your lifestyle, and that might be hard to go back. So I have advised clients that if you don't absolutely don't need that money up front, wait to get it like you have in the past.
This year's child tax credit will be refundable for the first time. What does that mean?
Well, that's kind of an open-ended statement. The child tax credit has been refundable in the past.
Okay.
But it was called an additional child tax credit. So the additional part of the child tax credit has been refundable for a number of years. What this child tax credit being refundable really means, what they've changed it is that people can get the child tax credit without having had to file a tax return for other reasons.
I see.
So in a scenario, if I have three kids, I don't work and I have no other reason for filing a tax return, I'm entitled to the child tax credit because it's refundable without ever having a reason to file a tax return, which will mean that people who have not needed to file a tax return in the past may be filing tax returns this year.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mary Mellum, who is a tax professional, operates Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. You can join in. Have you been receiving advanced child tax credit payments? Did you opt out of those payments, or did you know you could opt out? What will happen at tax time? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mary, what are some of the common questions you've been hearing from your clients about the child tax credit? What is confusing out there?
Well, there are two phase-out ranges that is different for this year. First of all, the child tax credit has increased, and there's two different increases. Number one, children under the age of six qualify for $3,600. And keep in mind, that's $1,600 more than that child would have qualified for in 2020. So that's $1,600 more that a family is going to get per child under the age of six. The other end of it says that the child tax credit has been eligible for children under the age of 17. They expanded the top end 1 year as well. So now the $3,000 credit is available for children under the age of 18. And all of this at this point is a 1 year shot. So who knows what's going to happen to it in the future, but it's kind of tough to take a look at this. Once people get used to receiving things, it's hard for them to go back. So I caution them to look at this extra $1,000 or extra $1,600 as a gift and use it as such. Don't rely on it because we don't know for sure where it's going to go. It may return to the rules that existed prior at the $2,000.
Let's bring on a caller now. Zach is joining us from Iowa. Hi, Zach. What is on your mind?
Good morning. I'm really glad I caught this conversation. We bought our house on a contract where we make a lump payment once a year, and we've set the payments up, so we rely on the tax return. every year. And now that they're taking it out early, it's not what we want to do. And we're not sure how to opt out of this. We haven't been able to find the resources yet to go that way.
So you haven't been able to figure out how to opt out of this. Do you have any suggestions there for Zach, Mary?
Well, the IRS created a portal, and it was anticipated for quite a while. And they finally, I believe in June, they finally got it up. But you have to go into that portal. You have to go into the IRS, set up an account so that you can get in to protect your information. And through that portal, you are able to opt out of the payment. Now, if you have been receiving the payments, November 15th is generally the next payment, and you wouldn't be able to opt out of that payment, but you could opt out of the December payment, which would be December 15th. So I would recommend that you go to the IRS website, key in child tax credit, and I believe that you'll find the site there, and then you'll have to set up an account. But I'm really glad that you brought up this comment, Zach, because there are people who, like you, do rely on that lump sum. And if you've gotten it ahead of time, what you were expecting is not necessarily going to be there.
Zach,
hopefully you put that money into an account and would have it anyway.
Zach, thank you for the call. We're discussing end of year tax issues and the child tax credit with tax professional Mary Mellum. Have you called the IRS with a question? How did it go? Has your tax bracket changed? And you wonder what that means about credits and deductions. Join in with your questions on taxes, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Mary Mellum. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the IRS and your taxes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tax professional Mary Mellum has been in the business for decades. She operates Eshwabenon Tax Professionals in Green Bay. She's fielding all of your end-of-year tax questions, questions on the child tax credit at 800-642-1234. So, Mary, one more thing I want to ask you about. People have been doing a lot of remote work in the pandemic. What should we think about if someone moved to another state in these times? What do you think about with taxes and whether you need to be paying in multiple states?
Well, that's a very good question, Kate. If you move to another state, you have to check into the how that state looks at the income. And generally, anyone who earns income in that state has to report the income based on their levels in that state. So they may be filing, depending on the move, if the move is a permanent move, they may have filed a part-year return in the state that they came from and need to file a part-year return in the state that they're going to or that they're taking up residency in. So it may be involving one federal return and two state returns. But each state is different, and each state has a minimum filing requirement. So they need to certainly check that out in the different states.
That could be tricky, too, because, you know, maybe you moved to a parent's home halfway across the country for 6 months in the pandemic, and you do intend to move back to your state you live in, and that could get, I would assume, pretty complicated.
Well, a lot of states look at what do you see as your permanent residence, and where did you keep your ties, your driver's license, things like that. The state of Wisconsin is very, very much that they don't like to let go of people. So before Wisconsin does not see you as a resident, you have to do some changes on a more permanent basis. But people who do go temporarily to another place maintain their Wisconsin residency and file as a resident of Wisconsin and may be filing as a non-resident of the other state that they're in.
Okay.
And that's not totally uncommon.
What about the new desk and chair we bought for the closet under the stairs? Can you deduct home office expenses?
Oh, that's a very good question. If you are an employee, you are not going to have an office and home expense. In the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017 severely limited the Schedule A for the miscellaneous itemized deductions. The employee business expenses were part of that limitation. So if you're an employee, there is no office and home deduction for you.
Mm.
You may be able to convince your employer to reimburse you for certain expenses, but that would be a non-taxable reimbursement if the employer were willing to go along with that. But it will not affect your tax return.
IRS doesn't want anything to do with your home office, apparently.
Well, if you're an independent contractor,
sure,
and you have a home office, that's a different story. That still exists.
Let's bring on Patrick in Madison with a tax question. Patrick, what's on your mind?
Good morning. What counts as taxable income in retirement? Social Security, withdrawals from pensions, IRAs, Roths, and then what counts toward the maximum? If you can only earn like $13,000 a year and then they start reducing your Social Security, what counts toward that $13,000?
Oh, you've got a lot, a big question there, Patrick. First of all, the earnings for Social Security purposes, if you are drawing Social Security and you are under the maximum retirement age, which is somewhere between 66 and 67, depending on your age. But if you choose to take Social Security before that, earned income counts against that. If you make more than that specific dollar amount that is assigned to early benefits, your earned income counts against that. That is income that you receive from wages, from being an independent contractor. So the earnings are what count against that, not your investment income, not your social, your withdrawals from your pensions, none of that. It is strictly earned income that goes to that limit. Now, the other half of your question was, what's taxable income when it comes to retirement? Any income that you earn during retirement is considered taxable income unless there's an exception. Social Security itself is taxable at two different level potentials, depending again on your income. If you earn a certain amount of income, it may be 50% of it is taxable. If your income gets above a higher level, 85% of it may be included in your income. If you're retired strictly on Social Security, none of it is taxable. Hmm. So it all depends on where you are in that status. And then you mentioned one other term, and that's Roth. The benefit of a Roth IRA is that you have already paid taxes on your contribution to the Roth. So if you take the Roth out at a time that you are over 59 and a half, that Roth is not taxable to you.
All right, Patrick, thank you. A lot to think about there. Here's another question, Mary. Lisa wrote in by email. Lisa received the child tax credit check but does not qualify because of their income, Lisa says. What should Lisa do with the check?
If that's a tough one. If she typically, if the IRS sends you a check that you're not entitled to, you can mail it back to the IRS. What I would suggest that she do first off is go to the IRS website and decline the payments. Because if she got this check, she's going to get another one unless she does that. As far as sending the check back, at this point in time, that may be more difficult to get the timing in for the IRS to acknowledge it before she files her tax return. And with the advance payments and with the stimulus payment, the IRS is still digging out of cross-checking what you say you got versus what they say you got. And it may be easier for her just to cash this check and reconcile it when she files her tax return. But if she doesn't want the next one, she has to go to the IRS portal and elect out of it.
Mary Mellum with us, tax professional in Green Bay, operates Eschwabenon Tax Professionals, taking on your tax-related questions, 800-642-1234. Mary, here's another pandemic-related one, another issue, PPP loans. Let's say you own a small business. How do you claim the, you know, your pandemic loan on the return?
The PPP loans were loans, and many people were able to get those loans forgiven. If the loans were forgiven, that normally would be taxable income. But again, because of the government programs, if you have loan forgiveness with PPP loans, those are not taxable. So it's not something that gets reported on the tax return. Certainly it goes into the books for the business that received it, but it is not either for federal or state a taxable consequence. And the federal government and the state government went one step further. And normally when you pay for expenses with tax-free money, you're not able to deduct the expenses. And they did absolve that for the PPP loans as well. So for the people that received forgiveness of the PPP loan, they do not have income, and they are allowed to take those deductions that they use the income with.
We have time for just one more question. Kalia in Milwaukee. Kalia, go ahead.
Hi. I am a mother of one, just had her in February, and I was wondering if there's something that I have to do to get the tax credit, because I haven't received anything yet. So what are the steps to take for that?
So a new parent and wondering how to get the child tax credit. Mary Mellum? Oh, and Mary, I think she just dropped off the line, Kalia. I'm so sorry. We lost her, I think, here in the conversation. But assuming going to the IRS site, there is probably more information there. Mary Mellum is a tax professional, and she operates Eschwabenon Tax Professionals, and she's been fielding your questions about tax season and the IRS. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network.